Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, defending children's right to their mother and father. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. This is your host, Katie Faust, and I'm the founder and the president of Them Before Us. We are a global movement that seeks to prioritize children before adults on all issues of marriage and family, but even beyond that, looking into broader cultural issues, even economics, and broader national issues as well. And we're going to be talking about some of all of that today on the show. We're going to start out with a little bit of Bible time because can't lay a better foundation than that. Then we're going to hit a few headlines, and then we're going to do some Q&A. We're going to do a little bit of audience questions that we've gotten through our social media channels. So we've got a lot going on, and we're glad that you're going to be with us for all of it. We are joined this morning for our first episode by Josh Wood, the executive director of Them Before Us, and he is going to go through a little bit of Bible time with us. How are you, Josh?
Doing great. Looking forward to Bible time.
Mm-hmm. Can't argue with a little Bible time. So I tend to go through an entire book at one time. I really like to dig into commentaries to kind of discover the hidden gold nuggets that you don't necessarily see if you're just reading it on your own. But this time we're going to start with one of my favorite psalms. And it's a psalm that really serves as a bit of a foundation for the work that we do at Them Before Us. It's Psalm 82. So I'm going to do a quick reading. And then Josh, I'd love to hear what stands out to you about this. And then I will try to not go on and on and on about what I love about Psalm 82. Psalm 82, a psalm of Asaph. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. And this is what he asks. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak and fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and needy. Deliver them from the hands of the wicked. That's the first half, but I'm going to stop there because there's a lot to digest. And just to set up a little bit of context here, this is God inquiring of the small g gods. And while there is a bit of disagreement among theologians about who those little g gods are, most of them land on the place that these are people that have been delegated authority in the literal courts. So these are human judges. And I would say that we can actually apply this standard to any person who holds any level of authority that has to do with deciding right and wrong, right? Deciding and meting out penalties and punishments for those that are accused and guilty of victimizing the vulnerable. And so this is God's charge to people that are in positions of authority and his expectation that they are going to make decisions that are not partial and that defend the groups that are very often victimized by the systems of power that are set up not just in Israel, but really that can be set up and abused in all countries of the world. Josh, do you have any initial thoughts on that psalm?
My first thought is just how much you hear the word justice at all in your different faith traditions. It's always struck me just how in some faith, and you go to church and you grow up and justice is every single Sunday. And for others, as I've studied and worked with this word and concept specifically, it's such a central part of God's character. But man, for some people, it just doesn't get emphasized enough that it's not one of those things that you hear over and over again when clearly, I mean, there's verses about how justice is a part of God's throne. I mean, it is central to who he is. And so, man, I do personally wish that was something that I had heard more growing up.
The thing that stands out to me, well, several things. You know, judges in that time especially, they would sit when they heard the case, but that they stand when they issue their decision. So this is God standing and saying, I have evaluated you. You have to answer to me. If you are not going to defend the most vulnerable, you're going to have to be judged in my court. So this is God saying, you're not operating outside of an authority. You operate under my authority. And he specifically lists two different groups, right? The weak and the fatherless in verse 3. And then it talks in verse 4 about the weak and the needy. And in the Old Testament, he lays out sort of the four demographics that were particularly vulnerable to exploitation. And you probably know what they are. It is the immigrant, it is the poor, it's the widow, and it's the fatherless. And all four of those demographics are outside of some system that God designed for their provision and protection. So the immigrant is outside of the national boundaries, which especially back in that day, you know, your kin, your clan, your tribe was a main source of protection for you. The poor are somehow, for some reason, outside of the economic system. They're not able to participate in the economy, whether it's because of a disability, whether it's because they've been ostracized for some reason. Widows are outside of the protection of the covering of her husband, and the fatherless are outside of the protection of their parents, specifically their dad. And when you're outside of these God-ordained systems of protection, then you really are vulnerable. So a lot of the work that we do at Them Before Us, and what you're going to hear over and over and over on Them Before Us Radio, is protection of the weak, protection of the needy, and specifically protection of children. And as we discuss, and you're going to hear over and over, one of the main ways that God protects children is through his design for sex and marriage and the family. God's setup of the family is plan A for child protection. And we're going to be critiquing, especially in some of our headlines, some of the ways, even just this week, that children have been victimized. And through politics, through some of our trending news that we're going to cover specifically, we're going to talk about how children today are being denied the justice, denied the protection that they need and that they're made for. And it is our job to give it to them.
Yeah, I would love to just segue that into just the veep stakes from this past couple weeks. You know, we've gone through two conventions, Katie, and or we're getting ready to go into our second convention. But in both cases, parties have selected who their vice president's going to be. And I'd love to talk through, you know, your take on, you know, what does that particular pick signal from each party on how they intend to protect children?
Yeah, it's kind of a tale of two VPs in a lot of ways. Because when we look at J.D. Vance as the VP pick, if we're looking at this from the through the lens of kids and who they are and what they need, J.D. Vance is the story of a kid who was completely outside of the protection of his married mother and father. He was outside of the economic systems that are supposed to provide for him. I mean, he really was vulnerable in a lot of the ways that God insists that we recognize and care for and protect. And, you know, he wrote an entire biography about this that was turned into a major motion picture about the struggles that kids experience when they are not raised in that healthy, whole, connected, intact family. And he grew up to be a man who said, I am going to create that for my own kids, right? So he really did buck a lot of the, you know, quote unquote inequities that he was born into, and got to the place where, really, because he chose to embrace God's design for the family, he will exempt his children from those same struggles. And so if he wasn't the VP pick, and before he was the VP pick, especially before he was a senator, he was largely heralded as a success case, as a guy who is living out these principles that are so needed if we're going to talk about turning the country around. So before we move on to the other VP pick, Josh, what are your thoughts on Vance and some of the media around him?
Well, I heard last week, you know, to always remember that parties exist to win elections. That they are not going to, you know, necessarily stick to principles and morals at all times. I agree with you that J.D. Vance has lived, you know, the breakdown of the family in some significant ways, and with his family, you know, having some history with opioid abuse and things like that. And has experienced in some cases some heroic family members stepping up to try to mend wounds. But I think what was disheartening about the first half of, you know, the veep stakes was that we saw, you know, a process with the platform where it didn't seem like there was a willingness from the party to have a discussion around pro-life values. And I know that's a broad blanket term, but I mean values that protect life and that are, you know, on the cutting edge here, talking about as we talk about, you know, assisted reproductive technology, that define what IVF is, that, you know, talk through what, how are we going to remake, you know, our policies on life issues post-Roe. I thought there was an opportunity here, having a convention, who we pick as VP, or who a party picks as VP, to really have a discussion about, well, what is our position now in this, you know, a little more uncertain landscape? There's new technologies making new things possible. There's a new legal landscape with Roe being overturned. I think there was an opportunity for conservatives to articulate, and I don't feel like that really happened. And again, they exist to win elections, mm-hmm. you know, and so we got to keep that in mind. But yeah, I will say I was a little disappointed.
If you're prioritizing kids, the disappointment was completely warranted. I like J.D. Vance as a candidate. I like him as a man, as a father. He's bright. He's articulate. I think he stands for all the right things. To be disappointed in what went down at the convention is completely merited, because it was a forsaking of some of the core values that Republicans have held onto, really despite a lot of different cultural winds and highs and lows in the political process. And to have an explicitly pro-life plank excised and really become a version of a pro-choice platform, really disappointing. To have the explicit mention of one man, one woman marriage taken out and swapped with, you know, their language of a sacred institution. I don't remember what it is. Yeah. Something that is much right. more subjective than what it was before. You know, people who are concerned and understand that marriage is the foundation for a healthy society and that children are vulnerable and deserve protection from the moment of conception. I mean, there were things to be highly critical of during that first convention.
The one thing I would highlight, though, is at least as unclear as Republicans have been at times, they have had a history of putting in place people who have stood strong and enacted things that have absolutely saved lives, protected kids, kept families together. And so I would say it was highs and lows. That's probably how I would say it, because I do think J.D. Vance has been clear on some things, has been more willing to articulate kind of a pro-life message that I've seen from the party at times. So I don't know, it felt like a little bit of a mixed bag.
I think that one of the biggest challenges is, as I have talked with friends that have all the way from 2016 through 2020 and now into 2024, who have had some challenges with President Trump, former president, current candidate, could be future president, and said, I don't know if I'm okay voting for him. What I would always say is vote the platform. Vote the platform. Even if you're not in support of the candidate, you can vote the platform. Well, now that platform is not open, offering the same level of assurances that it used to. So I do know some voters that are pretty conflicted, because they're like, now I don't know if I can fully support the man. And I don't know if I can bank on the platform offering the kind of guidance that matters to me, not just as a religious conservative, but as somebody who actually understands that you can't just reason away or excuse away or political away these core principles, because those core principles, they don't go away. They are either acknowledged and respected and recognized and articulated, or they will continue to exist and they will just bite you in the back because you're refusing to acknowledge the reality that individual rights begin at conception and that marriage and family are the vehicle of social thriving.
That's a good reminder that as Christians, our goal, our desire, our part of this process has to be to be concerned with principle and to hold each party accountable to what they're saying. Because as I've said before, most of the people who have to bear the consequences of these decisions aren't old enough to vote or testify. They are going to be the people in the womb still, or people that are growing up that are going to experience this family breakdown. So it is our job to hold people accountable. I know winning is a priority for these parties, but can we step in and try to, you know, re-articulate, reinforce our principles that are coming from the gospel?
And that is a pretty good way to capture the mission of Them Before Us. It is to accurately represent the rights, well-being, and interest of children in matters where they can't defend themselves. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to examine the other side of the ticket.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I am your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, and you're getting the audio version of our mission to take the rights of children and defend them all across the globe right here on American Family Radio. So you're going to be getting the child-centric perspective of trending news, some answers to your questions, and a lot of child-centric Bible time, which if you missed, go back and listen to it because Psalm 82 has a lot to say about our responsibility when it comes to defending kids. In the last segment, we spent a little bit of time talking about the Republican platform and the pick of J.D. Vance as VP. We're going to turn our attention now to the other side of the aisle, and we're going to talk about the Harris-Walz ticket. The presumptive presidential candidate for the Democrats, Vice President Kamala Harris, has chosen Minnesota Governor Jim Walz to be her VP candidate. And that has really set off some alarm bells among several people who have noticed that in a lot of ways, he has not been good for the state. And on this program today, we're going to talk about why specifically he hasn't been good for kids. So to help me run down exactly the kind of threats that specifically this ticket poses to kids is my executive director, Josh Wood. Josh, give us a little bit of background on what we're looking at with the Harris-Walz ticket.
So Tim Walz, obviously governor from Minnesota, he is an interesting choice. I heard a couple of people talking about how it seems like the top of each ticket has doubled down on who they are, with the Make America Great Again wing doubling down with a J.D. Vance who is, you know, a full-throated defender of that agenda. Well, Tim Walz from Minnesota would be similar. He is a progressive of progressives, if you want to say it that way. So how does that relate to us? You know, obviously, we do take an interest in the way that a number of issues affect kids. We have a book coming out soon, Pro-Child Politics, which we have an author that's going to be interviewed on an upcoming episode for this as well. But it takes each issue and says, in terms of the economy, in terms of debt, immigration, how does adults seeking their own desires impact children? And so I think we want to ask in this situation, how does the pick of Tim Walz impact kids? How does that impact their future? Well, we can look back at his record for governor. I think that's a great place to start. The thing that's just glaring, I guess, that is honestly a little hard for me personally to understand is this up to birth abortion bill that he signed into law. Katie, I don't know if you want to just start there, but that's a really hard one to stomach.
It is the most radical of the abortion laws across the states. And some have said, oh, it's not just up until birth, it's beyond birth. And that mm-hmm. we already have records. Well, we did have records of up to 8 children who were born alive post-abortion and then were denied life-saving care. But the governor decided he did not necessarily want to discuss or be held accountable for that. So then he absolved and abolished the record-keeping function. So we don't know how many children are born post-abortion and are being denied life-saving care. So what we have going on with this administration in Minnesota is, I would say, as most starkly as we can, a reversion to paganism. That's what this is, right? The pagan world that the Christian church was born into had a practice of exposing, they called it exposure, exposing unwanted or disabled or female infants and just letting the elements take their course, whether that was throwing them into a river, throwing them onto a garbage heap or whatever it was, and letting exposure to the elements or wild animals or whatever kill the child. I mean, what we're talking about is modern day exposure. So it's not just abortion, which is bad enough, but we are looking at a candidate and that is so radical that they will even go beyond abortion when it comes to denying and victimizing children around their right to life.
Yeah, I saw a couple of things as well. And this often happens, but around the debate around trans rights and even the redefinition of some words, there's starting to be in some of the bills that he passed, even some redefinition around what gets included in sexual orientation. I don't know if you want to speak to that, but also kind of a couple of bills that would begin to degrade a parent's role in the choices made to transition a child. Again, both of those things, I think when it comes to some of these discussions, you've got to recognize you're living in a society that has a lot of different opinions. And so I can think that there's debate, places to have debate about some of these issues. Every single one of the things I've listed, even trying to keep a very open mind, I'll admit, is very hard for me to see the logic behind. Again, you mentioned the post-birth not providing care when it's a botched abortion. That just seems heartless. That seems, it seems like, unless this is in service to some ideology that you're placing above everything else as a means to win or satisfy a wing of your party, it just doesn't seem like values we should be holding, or that I can even make sense of holding. And that doesn't happen to me very often in the political realm.
Well, I think you put your finger right on the heart of what's going on, and that is that adult sexual feeling, adult sexual desire is being elevated to the ultimate position of value, you know, I would say to a godlike status, under which everything else must be sacrificed. And you do see that with the pushing of the transgender agenda. You know, we've got comments from his administration, again, repeating this terrible lie that gender transitions is life-saving care, which it's not. I mean, it's child mutilation, quote-unquote, care. That's really what it is, which now we know thousands of children are rightly coming to regret. I just saw a first ever detransitioner who is now suing Planned Parenthood for the role that they played in providing her with testosterone that ended up creating these lifelong irreversible harms to her body. You know, I think that the meme that I've kind of seen going around the internet is emblematic of what Governor Walz thinks on this topic. And that is that he put tampons in the boys' restrooms in the schools in Minnesota, right? So therein, he's communicating biological reality is not the guide for him. It is ideology that is the guide. But what didn't get as much press, but what I think is incredibly concerning, was the redefinition of sexual orientation to not exclude pedophilia. So in the past, it has largely been a term that has connoted somebody's attraction related to gender, the same sex or two sexes, but has excluded age attraction. And in all three of the versions of the redefinition of sexual orientation, the governor himself crossed out the exemption of pedophilia from the definition of sexual orientation. Why does that matter? Because sexual orientation is being elevated to the level of race, something that is immutable, something around which you are prohibited from discriminating. So it elevates pedophilia to the class of you can't critique, you can't discriminate, you can't criminalize pedophilic behavior. Now, that is just about as predatory as you can get. It's passed under the guise of tolerance, under the guise of, you know, adult sexual identity. But make no mistake, the result is going to be child victimization in incredibly graphic and damaging ways.
I'd love to give an example of, you know, you could be tempted to say, that's Minnesota, Katie. That is far off. You know, maybe it's basically liberal California. Like, that's not coming for us. But I think as Christians, again, our job is to hold the line on principle. We're not called to win or lose here. We are called to hold the gospel-centric principles and to advocate for them and to hold everybody, regardless of party, to account for those values. That's our job. Well, we can't give inches here on things like this, because we've seen that people will say you're just, you know, you're fear mongering, you're playing like this is going to, you know, be some slippery slope. But I think we've seen time and time again how, you know, things like I think the legalization of same sex marriage, how that court case that came down, everybody remembers from Obergefell, how people said that's just going to stay in this small little box. But we've seen how that has turned into now there's a male couple suing for access to IVF under their insurance now, saying we have a right to another woman's body to create a child for us and our insurance to pay for it because we believe that's entitled to us as one of these benefits that came with this ruling. You tie this thread all the way there. I think we've got to be sure as Christians to say, no, this redefinition really matters. Words matter. Truth matters. And we're going to fight it as we at every step to make sure that this doesn't just go again down what ended up being a cliff.
Yep, that's exactly right. And I don't think that in the culture war, because it is, and I don't mind using that term, like this is war. And it's a war over culture. And culture is not nothing. Culture is the world that we live in, and culture captures people, and people are worth fighting for. And so we are in a war, not against flesh and blood, but we are in a war of ideas. And those ideas, when we get them wrong, they have very real victims. Almost always, the victims our children. So when we look at this culture war, I don't think Christians are called to be aggressors. We don't need to go out and slash and burn. We don't need to go out and put it in people's face. What you do need to do is stand firm. That is the role of the Christian. You plant your feet on the truth of God, which is validated through what we know about child development, social science, natural law. I mean, you can validate what God says in his word, especially about who children are, what they need, where they come from, to what they have a right. You plant your feet on that and you don't move. That's your role in the culture war. Now, because everything else is moving, because everything else is squishing, and if you stand firm, it might be perceived as aggressiveness, but it's not, right? It's simply you refusing to bend. It's you refusing to be conformed to the pattern of this world. Mm-hmm. And have that looks seen, like aggression.
Have you seen that meme where it's like it's one adult with their kid, and then there's like 1,000 people out there. And it says, the one I saw said, it's just a clump of cells. And the two people up against 10,000 people said, yeah, you're wrong. Like it just made this point that like might doesn't make right. I think to pick an example from, you know, a completely different context, think about divorce. That was one that we, as the Christian community, I think largely just kind of let go. We began really restricting this from a religious institution that was two people promising before God eternal love and commitment forever, bound together, except in very rare cases of abuse, abandonment, neglect. You know, the things that, again, were about protection, that protect the child, protect the spouse that is still in that marriage. Okay, well, no-fault divorce just kind of swept through to where now it's easier to get out of a marriage. You know, one of my friends is fond of saying, I don't know how exactly true it is, but it's easier to get out of a marriage than a contract for someone to paint your mailbox. It's like it's a joke, but there's some truth in it that they became these really optional arrangements where you can leave for any reason and pay the same penalty as the spouse who may be trying to do the heroic thing. And we've all borne the consequences as Christians of not saying, no, absolutely not. We're going to stop this, nip it in the bud in the beginning and say, this is wrong.
You know, I'm glad you brought up divorce. Because we've been talking about putting tampons in bathrooms, transing the kids, you know, abortion that goes through the third trimester and maybe even after birth in cases. And we look at that, or we look at the redefinition of marriage. We look at two men procuring children through a surrogate that is now, they are arguing, should be funded by the state. We're looking at stripping the words mother and father out of parenting laws, which is something that took place last week in Minnesota. And we go, oh my gosh, what is going on? And what we need to do is we need to go back a few steps and say, it didn't start with gay marriage. It didn't start with transgenderism. If you want to talk about the unraveling of the American family, it started with divorce. That was the first legal move to elevate the desires of adults above the rights and well-being of children. And it wasn't the gays. It was heterosexual people who fell out of love or had a hard time, making it work because obviously, marriage can be challenging. And once they had a legal option to escape the marriage, they took it. And now generations of children are bearing the brunt of that. And I would argue a lot of those kids are struggling with their identities, struggling to form and maintain their own relationships, struggling with their own sexual orientation because they didn't have the kind of intact, loving, daily presence of feasting on the connection with their own mother and father needed to form healthy identity, healthy relationships of their own, and believing that marriage and family, as God intended it to be, was even possible.
I think that's well said. Again, it just speaks to our position in this discussion. Parties exist to win elections. Candidates will come and go. Our job as Christians is not to, again, play the pragmatist role. When we have that hat on, and again, I get you go into the voting booth and you make a decision, it's one way or the other. But when we are together, as we are right now, talking about our principles and values, we have to hold the line, and we have to hold the principle that we find in the gospel and not compromise.
Yeah, that's exactly right. As Christians, we don't make decisions based on, is this politically advantageous? Will we win if I do this? We don't make those kinds of calculations, right? We actually live in some ways in a parallel economy. We are, you know, citizens with a foot on this world and a foot in the next world. And that actually makes a difference in terms of how we vote, how we engage, what we think, and who we defend. So we need to continue to be principled. And that is going to draw some ire from people around us who don't understand why we're not going along to get along. Why can't you just vote for this candidate? Why can't you just be okay? I mean, don't you understand it's the lesser of two evils or whatever it is that they want to say? We don't make those kinds of calculations. We stand on principle because when we don't, it's children who pay the price. Well, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break and then we will be back with your questions.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We're back with Them Before Us Radio, and we are at probably one of my favorite times, which is Q&A, because we like to hear from you guys. What are you thinking? Like, you're hearing all of these truths about children, but what does it mean for your real life? How do we raise our kids in this crazy culture? How is it that we can take these child-centric principles into our real life world? And to help us with that, we have, again, our training director, Jen Friesen here.
Hi, Katie. Excited to be here. Got some questions for you.
I want to hear them all.
All right. This one I think will be pretty applicable to most people listening because so many of us have friends or family that identify as LGBT, people we really love. And so Chris had a question. Is it okay to support our family members or families who are LGBT doing things like going to their weddings, et cetera? What do you think?
Yeah. So everybody's got somebody in their life that disagrees with them, whether it's how they identify or politically or whatever it is. And in my opinion, especially if you consider yourself a follower of Christ, you should be the sweetest, most sacrificial, not just reciprocating relationship, but initiating relationship with them. There is going to be areas of disagreement, but it always should be principles. It always should be biblical truth. It should not be us withholding ourselves from that friend or that family member. And, you know, like all of you, I have a lot of experience with this. My parents were married until I was 10, and then they divorced. And thankfully, I remained connected to both my mom and my dad. My dad dated and remarried. But very soon after the divorce, my mom repartnered with a woman, and they have been together ever since. So throughout most of my childhood, adolescence, early adulthood, once I got married as a young mom, and even up to today, my mom and her partner have been a really major part of my life and my children's lives. So is it challenging to sometimes hold these principles highly and unflinchingly and maintain a relationship with those who disagree? Yeah, it can be. But I don't think it's as hard as we make it out to be. I think the challenge is especially if you're like me, you're going to be tempted to soft pedal or downplay or even compromise what you believe to remain in relationship. And there's going to be a lot of people, maybe even from Christian sectors of your life, saying that's exactly what you should do. You should compromise. Maintaining the relationship is the most important thing. It's not. Holding fast to God's truth is the most important thing. But unity and reaching out in friendship is also extremely important to God. The way that I put it is, in one hand, you're holding fast to the truth of the word, and in the other hand, you're holding fast to the preciousness and the dignity of your LGBTQ identifying friend. And the world says, just do one or the other, or they'll say, you can't do both. But if you're a Christian, you have to do both, and you have to do both with all your might. And there might be times where you come to a crossroad and people will say, well, I guess we can't be friends anymore. You make sure that crossroad happens because you are refusing to compromise, not because you have refused to bend your life and extend yourself to them in a way where they know that you love them. I have so much more to say about this, but I'll let you jump in, Jen.
Yeah, what was coming to mind for me is some authors that have been very influential for me are Christopher Yuan and Rosaria Butterfield. And in they've both identified as gay. They became Christians. They Rosaria is married to a man and has children now. Chris Yuan is engaged to a woman now, which is super cool. Christopher Yuan, I remember him sharing that you should not go to an LGBT wedding because that is sort of pretending a marriage is something other than it actually is. It's putting a stamp of legitimacy or approval on something that a Christian cannot do. But he said your refusal to do so should be weighted with how much you love and care for them. He said it would be worth flying to meet with that family member in person to communicate, I love you, I care about you, here are the reasons my convictions won't allow me to do that. And I thought that was really neat, that it's not just, you know, shooting a text message and saying, hey, I can't make it because I'm a Christian and I don't agree with you. But really, like you're saying, you're trying to match the conviction with the amount of love you have for that person. And Rosaria Butterfield said something that has also stuck with me that says, Christians should never do anything that would make it harder for that person to repent. And you just think from the Them Before Us perspective too, we think divorce is horrible. So why would we go promote something that we don't acknowledge is marriage because it's not complimentary, it's not exclusive, you know, it's not meeting that criteria for marriage. And then when that person, if that person converts to Christianity and they're in a same-sex relationship, what are they supposed to do now? Well, their marriage is not considered legitimate in the eyes of God in the Christian perspective. So they'd be expected to divorce, and divorce is not good. And if they have children, all these things, you've complicated their life by putting your stamp of approval on things that God said not to do. So those stood out to me. And that's kind of the perspective I see when it comes to being, having conviction, but holding it with a lot of compassion and love for the people we care about.
Yeah. If you have not been faced with that question of, will you come to my same-sex wedding yet? You probably will. And my answer to that is, you don't go. You can't go. You can go to their birthday party. You should go to their birthday party. You should help them move. When they are sick, you should take them soup. But what is marriage? Marriage actually is something that cannot be changed, either from the biblical perspective or from the perspective of the rights of the child. I mean, marriage has served such a critical function, not just in our society, but in nearly every society when it comes to upholding children's rights and well-being. And a same-sex union does not do the same things that a heterosexual union does. We spend a lot of time in chapter 6 of our first book, Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement, talking about why that is and going through a lot of the studies on outcomes for kids with same-sex parents. So no, you can't go to the wedding. And if you're trying to figure out, like, why is that? It really boils down to one simple principle that helps both in terms of defending children, but also when it comes to raising your own kids. And that is, don't lie. Don't lie. Going to a same-sex wedding is a form of lying. You know, you're lying about what marriage is. You're lying about your support for it. I mean, even if you're going in the name of, well, I'm doing this because I love them and I want to communicate, I'm caring, you are actually communicating tacit approval and agreement. Your presence is a lie. So that's a bright line when we talk with our kids, raising them in Seattle in a very, very messy world, in a public school situation where there's a lot of different areas where they're trying to figure out what's the right thing to do here. We can always ask the question, are we lying? Are we agreeing to a lie? Are we approving of a lie? If so, the answer is no.
Great thoughts. All right, Katie, I have a question for you. With the new book coming out, Pro-Child Politics, you guys can pre-order right now. That should hit our inbox or, well, mailbox.
Mailbox, baby. Yeah. Give me that hard copy.
Snail mail, late September. So I'd love to know from you what your favorite chapter of the book was. Maybe a chapter where you feel like you learned a lot about a topic that you're not as familiar with.
The book has 19 evergreen political issues, political topics in it. I'm really, really familiar with the social issues that we cover: life, masculinity, femininity, family, race, gender ideology, pornography. I mean, I've done a lot of research, even doing my own writing and speaking about those. I really, really love those chapters, but there was a lot that I already know about it, didn't learn as much, but really, really appreciate what's in there. It's the other ones. It's the ESG and DEI and the digital technology and the national security and looking at the environment from the perspective of child protection that I was like, oh my gosh. I appreciated so much all these different experts that we conscripted into this project who took these massive topics and boiled them down to 3,000 words and made it really easy to understand. I think the chapter that I think about the most is the immigration chapter, the one on immigration and border security. And that was written by a woman named Laura Reese, who has been writing. She's a national expert on immigration and border security, and she writes about it a lot. And what I made every author do, because I'm just the editor of this book, what I required every author to do was to begin with the real life story of a child who was victimized because we got this wrong. And Laura tells a story about a girl being trafficked across the border. And I mean, this girl just represents thousands and thousands of kids. Like every day, we've got thousands of kids that are being victimized across the border. And obviously, our own children in this country are being victimized because of immigration policy. But the children themselves who are being brought across the border, especially the unaccompanied minors, which was made so much more. I mean, their numbers swelled greatly under this current administration. These kids are not doing well. They are abused on the way here. They are trafficked once they get here. They are not sent largely to family members or to safe places. They're often being conscripted into indentured servitude or being trafficked into all kinds of really horrifying situations. And so Laura just made it really clear that all these lies that we tell about immigration, you know, that our policies are racist or we shouldn't have a secure border, that not only are they lies, but they're very, very damaging to kids. And then she lays out the truth about immigration and these fundamental truths about why having a secure border is not just good for our children in our nation, but also children who want to come here too. So I think about that chapter a lot, especially in this political season where immigration is one of the top issues that people are concerned about. And I know, Jen, you've read a lot of the book. I don't know if you've had a chance to read all of it yet. None of us have hard copies. Sad. We're still waiting for them to come hot off the presses. But what have you read that you like?
Yeah, I've read a few of the different chapters, especially in preparing for interviewing some of the different authors, which has been really neat. One thing I liked under the national security or the foreign policy, one of the foreign policy chapters, was the idea of America. A truth is that America needs a stronger military in fewer places. And I've probably been one of those people that's a little more like, yeah, come on, we're the world's police because we're the strongest, most benevolent, whatever country. So let's just get military everywhere. And he was Dan Caldwell's chapter, and he did a great job of pointing out that you need to be strong and restrained. And actually that promotes both security and well-being at home, and it will promote well-being abroad. So that was really great. And then another section I really liked was the conclusion, which was written by Josh Wood, who works with us. And what I appreciated there was that it goes from a lot of abstract ideas, 19 topics that are really huge. It can feel very overwhelming. And the conclusion felt very practical. I think it's about 4 big points with some subpoints of how to take what we've read and kind of bring it to your own life in a practical way, building a network of your own people, being passionate about, you know, choose the things you're passionate about, become an expert in that and advocate for that thing. You can't advocate for all 19 and be an expert in everything, but choose that one thing you're passionate about and really advocate for it.
Mm-hmm. I know. I can't wait to have it in my hand because I'm going to mark that baby up.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. All right. Can you give us the elevator pitch on why IVF is wrong, or is it ever okay? And is there a possible way to do IVF ethically?
Okay. So here's the short answer on IVF. If you just want the hard, hard numbers, if you just need to shock somebody into the reality of this is not child friendly, what you need to know is that the IVF industry, it kills more embryonic life every year than the abortion industry. The way that we are conducting IVF these days, which is just in vitro fertilization, IVF, making children in vitro, in glass, when we are making babies in a laboratory, it is standard process to make many, 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 many more embryos than you ever intend to implant or to use. And so those children, the vast majority of them, are not even going to have a chance at implantation. Only about 10% of those babies are even going to be transferred to the womb. And then, you know, maybe half to less than half will actually take and form and be carried to term. And so when you look at the raw numbers, only 3 to 7% of these children are going to be born alive. So while IVF represents about 2% of children born in this country today, that 2% is a fraction of the children that we are manufacturing in a lab. And our opposition to IVF is not that those 2% of children born today are bad. It's all of the other children that didn't make it through the process are just as worthy of life and protection as the 2% that did.
Well, and we get a lot of pushback, different comments, folks who have done it. I mean, the most ethically they would say, we only fertilized this number of eggs. We didn't freeze them. We used all of them. 4 out of the 5 took or worked or born, et cetera. And so they'll kind of try to make the case that we did it in the right way. And our point is, what about all the ones that did not survive, right? That it's this larger picture than an individual doing it the right way.
And I have met, I mean, at this point, I have spoken to rooms containing thousands and thousands of people about IVF and the moral perils around it, and about how there's so many children that are victimized through this, either because they are deemed non-viable and discarded, they don't make the literal grade and are thrown away, they're not the right sex, they spend their existence in a freezer, they never emerge, maybe they are selectively reduced in terms of like an abortion because the child isn't developing, or there's too many that are developing. And I talk about all of the perils. And at this point, I've had 6 couples say, I actually did it. I actually used every embryo. I didn't freeze any. We didn't do any kind of genetic testing on them. We implanted all of them. It is incredibly rare for a couple to do this in a way that respects children's right to life and right to their mother and father, not using anybody else's sperm or egg or womb. And oftentimes the ones that have done it have had to fight their own doctor or clinic to do it in a way that respects children's rights. That's all we have time for today. We'll see you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.